Welcome. We are back yet again. It's our June Wine, Women, and Song podcast. Today I have with me, of course, my lovely wife, Paige. Paige, say hello.
Hello.
And also we're back with Zoe.
Hello.
And Jessica.
Hello.
And today we have a lovely new guest, Megan Dimmick. Megan, do you mind saying hello and saying a little bit about yourself?
Hello, and I am Megan, and I have gotten my undergrad and master's in vocal performance, and was an excellent poor starving student, or artist, and then went to culinary school, so I feel happy to be here talking about music and wine.
And she brought some lovely wings that we've been noshing on, so
yeah.
It's Wine, Women, Wings and Song tonight, which is great.
Nothing wrong with that.
Also, this evening, the wines we're going to be tasting will all be Côte d'Aronnes or Côte d'Aronne-style wines, meaning GSMs or Grenache Syrah Mourvèdres. We're all looking forward to tasting that. We've already poured glass number one. Without further ado, we'll probably move into our first selection. Here we go. Impressive, you know,
that's very,
contrabass.
Very meaty bass, bass fade out there.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
I feel like everybody's continuo on everybody's Bach recording is different. It always, it just sounds so different in every single one, and I just love this one. I love that bass.
And it was a man.
Bass.
Yeah. It was just her first male
singer. Male singer. Oh,
first,
yeah.
She's the first male singer in Wine, Women, and Song.
Yeah.
Well, other than the counter tenor.
Right. Where you can't.
That's
right.
True.
It was a little hard to turn up.
Yeah, that was gorgeous.
Yeah.
That was really gorgeous. What is the... I'm not familiar with the piece.
It's from St. John Passion.
Mm-hmm.
It's Bach. And I am very embarrassed to say that until I sang St. John Passion, I didn't realize, like, you know, you listen to the, well, I didn't realize how amazing this was until I heard it being performed, like, by a person standing right next to me. And I was like, that is the most... Of course, you listen to the recording. There's something about, you know, when there's somebody standing there singing it really well next to you. Paige was in the performance as well. She was one of the singers. And I don't know how you felt about it, but for me it was just, like, an amazing moment when the bass stood up and sang it.
Yeah.
Because it's just... so simple and so complex all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the harmony is amazing. This singer specifically, I love the way that he uses a little bit of straight tone on some of those
tracks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it feel so achingly, like,
pulled. Has this
yes.
pull to it because he uses the straight tone.
Yeah.
So beautiful. And when we did it, I guess it had, there was the organ for the, and then I've also heard it with Fiorbo as part of the continuum, which I actually love. But this one is a recording conducted by Masaki Suzuki, who's this Japanese Bach specialist. Have you guys heard of him?
No.
Yeah.
And supposedly his group, I think, has recorded every cantata and all of the big works. So this was the Japanese bass. And I just think it's just...
Well, I think one of the cool things is that, you know, last podcast, several times we talked about text painting, and he does a really good job here. And that's something that a lot of times, you know, these Bach kind of accompanied recitative things really count on the singer being able to do that.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and so often with Bach, too, I think a lot of people, when they think Bach, they think all the runs. But, you know, that doesn't...
Well, right after this, there's a
simple.
Shitload of runs.
Right,
tenor.
But, you know. Yeah. Right. Yes, but this particular aria, not so much. So.
No.
It reminds me a little bit in its, like, beauty of Machadech with the one from St. Matthew, which is another amazing bass aria. And, I don't know, it just gets me every time. It just, amazing.
Well,
yeah.
That's good. Well, that was kind of short in terms of excerpts. So before we talk about my number one, we're going to move on to the second selection here.
Keep drinking your wine.
So keep drinking number one.
Oh, Masaki Suzuki, the guy who conducted that performance, was just here. Oh.
We'll go back to that.
Oh, what but I thought that would be inappropriate. So
okay, so that was my selection, and I think it's ironic that it was put right next to the Bach, because when I was in college, I had to study Bach and you had to do it, but I did everything I could to stay as far away from it as possible because we just didn't get along. And I married my husband, David, and his brother does all of these Bach cantatas. He has this Bach choir, etc. And I wound up doing all of this Bach, and I thought, how ironic, I had finally graduated. So I find it very ironic that the two were put together, one next to the other, and that I chose my selection because I love his voice in that song, and it's not an opera singer singing musical theater. It's the right texture within that, just like I think when we heard the Bach before. It was just the right. I enjoyed the selection before, because I think the singer was appropriate to what we heard for what we were doing.
Well, I mean, I love Gordon McRae's voice. I mean, I knew because I'd seen the movies when I was a kid, but I didn't really know who Gordon McRae was until, you know, because I didn't pay attention. Obviously, I'm not really good at that on my page, but.
You're good at paying attention.
I feel like I'm not
cute.
Sometimes. But like, you know, so I go to Peabody and they're like, yeah, like a great Gordon McRae. I'm like, who the hell is the great Gordon McRae? You know? So, you know, back then, didn't quite have Google yet. So, you know, went into the Peabody Library and did some looking up. And I'm like, oh, of course. But, I mean, the other great thing about this piece, and one of the reasons I picked it, is because Oklahoma is actually a really kind of major benchmark in Broadway musical repertoire, in that Rodgers and Hammerstein were really trying to do something new in musical theater, where all the songs had something to do right organically from the character, which is much more like a lot of more late Romantic period operas, where you had less arias and songs that were just kind of put in versus telling the story. And so the text is supposed to be things that, you know, somebody might just say to themselves, or the feelings that they're going in the moment, which eventually led into Carousel, which, if you heard the recording this weekend on the radio broadcast from Lyric, you get a lot more of that sense of it's just very organic, I guess is a good word for it. But I think that's part of the reason why everybody has sung this to themselves at some point, because it just feels, it sounds like something you would say, oh my God, what a beautiful morning, you know?
The other thing about Oklahoma is that's the first time they added ballet into musical theater.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
I don't know which is the first opera that started to do that, but
way back when, I imagine.
It also just sounds like summer, you know? Like, I think of summer. It's just so perfect for right now. And I totally agree with you, Megan. Like, there is no other guy that should ever, I mean, how perfect is he for that? I mean, he has so much, he sounds so masculine. It's just like, oh, it's just so fabulous.
Which actually, when I picked it got me to thinking, I wonder how much we succumb to what our first hearing of something is. Because
yes.
This is definitely my childhood recording with Shirley Jones. And I've listened, when we did this, I tried to listen to a bunch of different singers singing it. And I thought, no, no, no. But you wonder how many times is it because it was the original one.
And did he originate the role?
Yes.
Well,
okay.
I don't know if he did it on Broadway. He was in the movie version.
Okay.
I don't think he did it on Broadway. At least, because I remember reading, like I said, about him. And then one of the other cool things he did, which I've actually listened to a couple, because they're now on the internet, he did this program called, I think it's called the Railroad Hour. And basically, it's like a 30-minute radio show where they condensed operettas and musicals. And they, like, really did little snippets of the songs, and they told the stories all in, like, 30 minutes. And he was the host of that show. And he had an interesting background because he didn't immediately go into theater. He just came out of World War II after being, you know, I think it was a pilot, and then, you know, had a singing voice and started to, you know, get the connections. And I'm sure the military background didn't help, you know, it didn't hurt for, you know, being easy on the eyes for the ladies and everything. So
Yeah.
How many of us have been in Oklahoma? Raise your hand.
Have what?
Been in Oklahoma.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I have been in other musicals, but not this one.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay. Has anyone been in it more than one time?
In Mochella. Yeah. Wow.
Were you Lori?
That was Jessica.
I was Lori once, and I was the really obnoxious laughing one.
Gertie.
I was Gertie.
No,
you
have,
were?
I was.
Oh, how it's so
I had a snorty
fun,
laugh.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I just love Oklahoma so much. It's one of my very favorite things in the world. Were you?
What?
Were you Lori?
I was not Lori in Oklahoma. I've never been. I mean, I was just, it was middle school. When I was
oh,
gotcha. Yeah.
Middle, yes. I just love it.
Yeah. I got
great
to,
choice.
I got to be Judd.
Oh, wow. That's a great role.
And my favorite was one of our friends who was playing Curly, and he was asking his daughters, you know, afterwards, oh, what do you like? Who do you like? And his one daughter was like, I liked Judd. And he was like, oh, is that because, you know, Jay's playing? No, I like Judd. I was like, you are going to have your hands full when she dates.
Maybe you didn't think, maybe you weren't mean enough, Jay.
Oh, I was
not,
pretty
they're not
mean.
Supposed to like Judd.
I was quite mean.
I thought that's a lower part than
it is.
What you said, yeah.
You know, I have a low background. So.
A low history,
yeah,
if
exactly.
You will.
Friends in low places.
Yes. But one of the things that I left out of the last podcast and barely remember to include in this one was chocolate, which Paige has already broken into.
Yeah,
so
you probably
you
heard. I was,
well,
yeah, I was going to mention there were probably in the past 5 to 10 minutes you probably heard two extraneous noises. The first was me opening the chocolate with the crinkly crinkly. Then you probably also heard something that sounded like growling. Which was actually growling, as I think we mentioned last time. We are in the living room of the Spy House and Zoo. The Spy House and Zoo typically has two Labradors and two cats. And this week we have an additional Labrador, Shelly, who is visiting. And Shelly, you know, she was rolling around and growling a little bit. So it's not any of us in gastric distress. It's Shelly. So.
Lovely.
No worries.
She was just enjoying the music.
A lot.
She is a, you know, she's in a family of...
Musicians,
and opera singers, so,
well,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about wine number one.
Yeah.
You know? What did we think of this?
It's really nice. It's very tart.
It is tart, yes.
Mm-hmm. In
that's
a nice
good,
way.
That's a great, that's a great way. I was trying to think, like, is it sparkly, like, sort of, you know, like acidic, citrusy, something
well,
like
it is,
that?
Well,
like,
it
tart
is acidic.
Is a good...
But tart, tart's a way of saying acidity.
Yeah,
and...
yeah.
I feel like very tart cherry is what the big fruit note
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it has a... It's funny, though, because it has a very earthy nose. It doesn't really have so much of a fruity nose. I mean, there's a little fruit there, but it's more earth. But then you taste it, and it's, like, all tart cherry, as you said.
As someone who cooks a lot, I think about what tastes good when I'm preparing a meal without any food. And I think this is very pleasant to just drink as I'm, you know... making
well,
a reduction sauce.
Cotoron is a great summer wine because it is. This is a medium to light body. You know, it's not really heavy, and also that you can probably notice it's got a little chill on it. And Cotorons do well with a little chill, so that's very nice as well. All right, so I'm gonna start the next piece, but then I'm gonna pour wine number two while it's starting. If everybody wants to maybe. Get their glass empty or grab some chocolate, I think, is
the
MO.
Do you want some?
Oh,
thank you. Esito. Say Figaro, Cose Sento. I mean, I've sung the Count, so I knew that immediately. It's fantastic scene. Why did you pick it, Zoe?
Yeah, I was curious.
So, I am a guitarist, not a singer, and classical guitarist. So I know some opera, but I'm not, you know, as probably well versed as the other fellow podcast members. But I mean, the Mozart operas are ones that I've always really enjoyed, and this is one that my husband really likes, and actually he uses this. So for a couple of years he's not doing it this summer, but for a couple of years he's taught the I forget the exact name of the class, but sort of an opera writing workshop for high schoolers that the Lyric Opera runs, and he uses this scene as an like kind of a perfect example of like perfect writing, because it, like, the first three entrances, I mean, they sound completely different, the Count and Susanna and Basilio, but they all have the same exact kind of stress pattern, and they all rhyme, and so it gives you, it's this, like, amazing kind of structure in, you know, what sounds very different, but yet it's sort of, like, locks it together so beautifully, and it gives you this, like, kind of real freedom to, you know, to do whatever. And I just really love, I mean, I love the music of Mozart, but I also really love this recording because I feel, so this is John Elliott Gardner conducting, and I'm going to look up the singers because I don't, they're famous.
It's our first live recording today. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. So it's Rod Gilfrey, who is the Count, and Allison Hagley, who is Susanna, and Francis Egerton, who is Basilio.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I don't remember the name of the workshop, but it's sort of, I think it's on period instruments. And so there's this sort of brightness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the performances are so beautiful because they're so clear and so well executed, but there's not this sort of extra layer of, I don't know. It's the way that kind of you want to, when you're performing great music, you need to make sure that it's the composition that shines. And I feel like that's just done so well in this. I appreciate it too. And the thing is, there's also like a YouTube video, and it's very well acted. So if anyone is interested, like if you look up this recording, the acting is really excellent. So.
Well, I just think, you know, Basilio is one of those parts in the Notes of the Figaro that often they cut the aria, you know, for the character. And you just got to be a character type tenor that has a lot of fun, you know, with that role and being a little slimy. And one of the things I recall is when I did this opera in the chorus at Wolf Trap, and Larry Brownlee was the Basilio. And anybody who knows that name now, I mean, he's like having a mega career.
Oh,
and there he was singing the Basilio at Wolf Trap, kind of a thankless role. But they put the aria in for him, which he ripped to shreds. It was incredible. But also, it was all the nuances he brought, just like this guy,
yeah,
to making it have that kind of like, you know, pithy viperness, you know. I just love in the recording. And this is, you know, Gilfrey and the Sedano, they're great. I mean, they're great as well, but I picked up on that a lot.
Yeah. No, I loved him.
Yeah, and it's so funny today because I think sometimes people act like, or it maybe feels a little bit like it's trite to like Mozart, but, you know, he's just so brilliant. Like, you can't, you know, it's like everybody says, oh, yeah, Mozart, you know, everybody likes Mozart. Well, there's a reason everybody likes Mozart. Like, it just...
I think it was interesting because I think that our first selection, the Bach selection, there was... You couldn't not know that that was Bach.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been with music a little bit.
Yeah.
And you could not not know that was Mozart, even if you weren't familiar with that particular opera. And all I could do is equate it to food. And with Mozart, it's the fish that shines through. There's not some special sauce that has to cover.
Exactly.
But guess what? You better cook that fish exactly correctly.
Oh, what a good way of describing that.
And
yeah,
you better have the exact wine to go with that. And it's funny because we were drinking this wine and I thought, this wine works so much better with Mozart. It's just a little bit more complicated and a little bit more interesting, but not overly complicated because you taste the different flavors. And that's exactly what I was thinking about when you chose that selection.
Well, it's funny, you walk right into the wine.
I know, boom.
I think this wine has opened up since I first poured it, which is not like what's been 5 minutes.
Yeah, no,
six
I would
minutes.
Agree.
Like when I first poured it, it was seemed very overly leathery and earthy, and that covered things up. But then, as I sat here and you know sipped it during the Mozart, and it's definitely opened up, and it is complex, just like you said. But the fruit started to come more forward. It actually has a lot more going on than the first one.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Peppery, dare I say.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and I think they're, it's nicely balanced between the fruit and the earthiness, which is nice. It's very sippable. You know, you can have it with food, but you don't have to, I would say.
And you have it with Mozart.
You can have it with Mozart.
Know.
You
Delicious
could probably
Mozart's.
Even have it with Bach if you wanted.
You we'll
Bach
go back real quick to Bach.
Is definitely
you know,
not.
Yeah, no.
I don't mean to mislead the non-performing listeners here.
Oh,
that,
I didn't.
I wasn't suggesting you were, but like, yeah, that's. I don't know. Singers. I mean, I don't sing Bach, but I play Bach, and yeah, it doesn't.
Bach is
it's
like
hard.
Fusion cuisine. To get
it's
it
the
exactly
hard,
right.
Yeah,
it's
the hardest thing.
It is the hardest
thing. It is
the
hardest. It's just relentless.
It's like
you
calls upon everything you got. You've got to use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember I used to, back when I was a baritone, and one of the reasons I decided I would be a tenor was I had said things like, you know, I could go out drinking all night and then get up in the morning and sing anything I wanted to as a baritone, except Bach.
That's correct.
It's like Bach, you need like all your faculties. You can't, you know, can't just wing it.
We would do these Bach cantatas, and the last, you just think to yourself, oh dear God, that tenor aria, thank God I'm not a tenor.
Yeah.
Me too.
I think he really didn't like tenors. Because the tenor arias are always the hardest. Not that the others aren't hard.
No,
so
I
they're ridiculous.
That, I mean,
they had a tenor in his churches, a couple of tenors that were just so ridiculously amazing.
Mm, maybe.
That he just, I think that must have been what, I mean, how well.
And how to tune it.
Fun. You were going to say something back when we were finished the book about
Suzuki.
Sorry,
yeah, I was
butting
in again.
No.
So, Masaki Suzuki, I think I'm pronouncing it right, I hope I am, but he was in town speaking of Mozart with the BSO to do Mozart Mass in C minor.
Oh.
And Joe, my husband, was at the performance because another friend of ours was performing in it and said it was one of the most amazing concerts he'd been to in a long time. And our good friend, Mr. Harp, I think, was playing organ, the portative organ for that performance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And so, I don't know, guys. Mozart, for me, Bach and Mozart, I want to have a phone case of each of them and just switch it out. You know, like, one day I'll have my Mozart phone case and then... Did I just say that on the internet?
We should have a picture of Jessica's phone case for anyone on the website.
Mm-hmm.
People can also enjoy her phone case because her phone case is quite enjoyable.
Yeah. Mozart is my guardian angel and he comes with me on my phone every day.
So when she takes a picture of you, it looks like you are looking at Mozart.
Yeah.
He is watching you because that is what you see. That is the face of Mozart, like, on the back of her phone.
That's pretty cool.
On any given day, would you choose Bach and Mozart then? And I know they're all great. I get that. But Bach and Mozart over a Verdi or Puccini?
See, that's a... See, Megan, there you go. You're asking these really tough questions that I don't know.
I'm asking you a cherry versus chocolate. A dessert that has fruit in it versus a dessert that has chocolate.
It would be how I'm feeling that day.
Oh,
see, I love these guys. I don't know. Mozart, I think, might have my heart. I think he really might have my heart. But Verdi, Puccini, Bach, all these guys, I love them all. Can't get enough.
I think for myself, I mean, like, I gravitate a lot to Verdi. I love Verdi, but I...
The drama.
Well, probably.
Are you a tenor or something?
But I mean, Verdi is about the baritone. Let's be
honest.
True.
Oh, very good point.
But regardless, I mean, like when I go, whenever I hear Mozart, I'm always like, oh shit, this is that really good stuff I keep forgetting about because it's like I've done it, I've sung it. Yes, it's good, but it's like, okay, let's move on to something else. And then, like, you know, a couple weeks go by or a month or 6 months or whatever. And then I hear it on the radio or like this. And it's just like, pow, why am I not listening to this more often?
It's so exciting. Like, you hear the opening strains of Cosa Senta. And you're like, already, it is just electrifying. For some reason, for me, I just like get so excited when I hear that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Is that how you feel too? And I think that recording really exactly
it is really good.
Said.
And I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I should have sent Jay a good. We have the CD. I couldn't figure out how to get it for my husband.
Well, you know.
Anyway,
second podcast. We're working.
Second podcast.
All that,
yeah, right? Yeah. But absolutely, yeah. It's really sort of this immediate. Has this real immediacy, and that. You're all of a sudden, like, kind of swept up. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
Feels the same way.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next selection. I'll start pouring wine number 3. Is that okay with everybody?
Oh, I guess.
All right. Good.
You have to dump it out.
You can.
There's our Verity.
Wow.
You guys know who that was?
Yeah.
I don't.
Leontine Price.
Oh, okay.
Whose choice was that?
It was my choice.
Very, very good choice.
Oh, well, thank you. I felt like it was a little pedestrian.
Are you
joking?
Are you kidding me?
You know, when people think of the typical opera fans, like, they like Aida. And if you like Aida, you have to... Well, you don't have to love Leontine Price, but, I mean, she's sort of like
I think you have to.
She's the quintessential Aida.
I think that you can't, like, hear that and not just think, totally blown.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and for me, like, that... Aida was the first opera that I ever performed in, and we did it in concert, and it was, like, you know, just stage chorus.
I remember
so
when I met you in that, you blew me off.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Oh, I'd like to hear more about that.
Sidebar.
Yeah.
Hey, no. That's a fun, long story.
Is that
but,
another podcast?
Yeah. But, so, it was probably for me, like, I mean, I think I'd probably been to a few operas before, but it was the first one that I felt like I really connected with. And so I've always loved Aida because of that. And it's one that I can, because I know it so well from rehearsing it so much, like I can put it on and listen to it and enjoy it and feel very familiar with it. And, you know, Leontine Price, I mean, she's not the most perfectly correct technical singer ever.
She can do anything she wants.
She can, but it's just like, you know, it's so emotional. Like, she really hits all of those moments in there.
I mean, I would not question Leontine's technique. I think what makes her so special is she's not concerned about singing things technically correct. She's concerned about really emoting what she's singing about and trusting that her technique backs it up 100%. And I, personally, it's more exciting to me to listen to singers who are not in, you know, a technical zone.
I totally agree, which is why I love that particular recording, because it's just
so good.
But what is the point of technique? The point of technique is to be able to do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it. And I don't recall her ever having vocal trouble.
No.
And so she would just change the color of a voice that maybe wasn't within technique, standard maybe, but the point is so that the whole point of technique is to do what you want and then be able to do it night after night after night, I think.
Amen.
I would
agree.
Totally. Well, that's a very meaningful one for me, because the first thing I remember ever, the first time I ever remember hearing opera or seeing opera was I was at my grandparents' house. My grandfather was watching a broadcast of the Metropolitan Opera. Aida was Leontine Price and Plácido Domingo.
Oh.
I was 8 years old, and I was like, holy wowzers. Like, I couldn't believe, I was like,
you said wowzers.
What is this? No, I didn't. No, I'm sure I didn't say anything. I think I was just in rapt attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really brings back a lot of memories for me. Thank you, Paige. And no, Leontine is. Her Vici d'Arte is also particularly ridiculously amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just feel like there's something in her voice that sounds like human.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, also that's how I feel about Callis's voice. You could just, she does, there, we, you know, overly polished thing, she just sounds so real and free. There's something so free about her singing. And it's just...
But if you get a chance, see if you can look up and find her recording of her singing this at her Met Farewell concert.
Oh my.
You know, in 1985. And you'll sit there and go, why in the fuck is she retiring? I mean, because it sounds glorious.
And that's why.
You know, she definitely decided to retire when she, you know, before she was at all, like, on the downside. But I saw it on video cassette years ago, so it probably is on YouTube. But if you can watch it, there's like, I don't know, an insane amount of applause afterwards. I want to say like 3 minutes of applause at least, or more, when she finishes this piece. And she's trying to hold this composure in. And like, it's amazing because you can see on her face throughout the piece all the improper emotions, but then afterwards, to watch the emotions on her face for those minutes during the applause of like trying to just be the diva of this is what's here and I'm just, yep, applaud. And then all of a sudden you can see the delving into her soul of the meaning of this is at this point in her career that she's retiring and she's fighting being overcome by it. It's an amazing little piece of cinema.
Hey, Zoe.
Yes.
As a classical guitarist, you chose Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why. And we heard the Bach, especially with the continuo. Do you gravitate more towards that kind of music, or do you gravitate, or Verdi and Puccini as well?
To be honest, I mean, this I thought. Let me just back up. So I do tend to like. I mean, I also just kind of like early music. Like,
mm-hmm.
I have enjoyed playing early music. I like listening to early music. So, and then as an instrumentalist, too, some of the more kind of probably modern vocal techniques, like, that, or, I don't know, that, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm not articulating this very well, is I think I like singing, too, that... emulates instrumental playing. So, and at least
that's
what I
would think.
Right,
that's...
what I really appreciated about this is the sort of, like, I mean, how powerful her instrument was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who the singer was off just by listening to it. I've of course heard of Leontine Price, but like listening to how powerful her instrument is, like her versus the orchestra and how amazing that was, but then also the interplay between how dramatic the orchestra was too in their, you know, dynamic range and that interpretation. So
I thought the orchestra was great on this recording.
Yeah,
and I was gonna also say that another one of my favorite things about this aria is the interplay between the soprano and the oboe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you know, I think it really pushes the emotion forward as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're in a monologue.
Yeah.
Very, it's, you know, it's funny because I'm still thinking about Megan's original, your question about, like, would Bach, Mozart, Verdi, Puccini, they just, I don't know, they all, I guess the reason that they're so special to me is that they all have that amazing ability to, like, evoke such an emotional reaction. Like,
so I want, as a singer, who would you choose to? Where do you sing? If it, what's your fa? Are you more Bach? Are you more Mozart? Or are you more Verdi?
More Mozart. Yeah.
And so now I think to myself, I wonder if our ultimate loves are because we're musicians. Is it what we would normally gravitate to as? Because
to
this exactly,
practice.
This is
yeah.
where
yes.
I would go. I'd want this whole dramatic thing where I could be dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want her high notes that she had to do.
Me neither.
And
this
that really,
stressful.
Really low
yeah.
one. But she gets to tell a story, and she gets
mm-hmm.
a long time to do it. And
yeah.
Whereas Bach, I think, oh my God, everything is so perfect and in tune, and Mozart just has to be. Just on too.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Well, it's like food, Megan. It depends on what you're in the mood for.
Oh,
yeah.
You know? So
that's
I didn't
totally.
Want to keep going back to food,
no, but,
my thought came to this as well, and that is with this particular. I love the arias of Puccini and Verdi and et cetera, and the heavier ones. But I don't know if I want to make a steady diet of the whole opera. Whereas Mozart, I could make the whole opera could be the meal for the night, and I won't feel a little overloaded. But this is just a little.
It's like ribeye.
It's exactly what I want, but I can't have ribeye and then the duck confit and then the lobster thermidor. All, you want a
yes,
little
I
variety.
Unless you have teeny tiny
lobster
portions.
Oh,
yes,
I think it is.
I think it is so.
And don't you think Mozart is, well, it's like champagne and like it's
champagne
and
chocolate together, maybe.
What do you think, Megan?
Mozart could have a beautifully crafted puff pastry, something like that.
Oh,
because it's really hard.
It is.
Or a cheese souffle.
Oh, there you go. Mozart has a cheese souffle.
It's so delicious, and you wouldn't think to get it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it could be that good, and then you eat it, and it's exactly right. It's really good.
Yeah.
And
Verdi
it's not
put
easy
in the
to
chocolate.
Make.
And
yeah,
Verdi's
complex.
In the chocolate.
Yeah.
Verdi's like a very intense chocolate cake.
And Bach is
just
this thing that I don't understand. It's this cuisine. It's like Asian cuisine. You know, you get all these different sauces, and I don't know. I keep trying, but I can't quite figure it out.
Nice. What do we think of wine number three?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
It goes really well with the Verdi.
I know, yeah, it's a little heavier. And then you didn't
think it's
interesting.
I
didn't have any clue. But yes, it is definitely the heaviest of the three.
Mm-hmm.
Very fuller bodied, darker fruits.
It's not like, I wouldn't really know that this was a Cote d'Aron, to be honest with you.
I was thinking the same thing,
yeah.
It has a really nice finish. I would put it more in like the, I don't know, I feel like I've had some Cote d'Arons that are this heavy. Limoncello!
Yes, Cote d'Arons have a large variance. This is definitely on the heavier end for one, I would think.
I'd say that's my favorite of the three.
What's your favorite of the three?
I don't know. I kind of like the first one, I'll be honest. For the summertime.
Yeah.
I can see. Would you call it a porch pounder, Jay?
It's what I would call the anti-porch
pounder.
It's
too good for a porch pounder.
I mean, porch pounders are mindless things you drink.
Oh, okay.
You're just wanting to drink something.
I just want to pound something on
right,
the porch.
Right, I think anti-porch pounders are things that you will tell Joe that. But the fact of the matter is, an anti-porch pounder, I think, is what it is that it's a little more complex, meaning while you drink it, you're like, oh, this is neat, this is interesting. And then you turn to your friend and go, shit, we finished the bottle.
You don't even realize it
was going down so easily. Whereas a porch pounder, you are literally just like, I just want to knock this back. Because you're not thinking about what you're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think about what I drink. So
I do love this.
Yeah. This is a really nice one. So we'll reveal the wines after we listen to the Baltimore Opera Company archival recording that I picked out. Now, unlike the last one, I have absolutely no clue who these singers are. This is the From the Dump section, for those of you who remember the last podcast.
They're
on the way to the dump. Or,
they're not dumped yet, they're in
right,
the basement.
Right, on the way to the dump.
Not technically breaking the law.
They often have a lot of distortion on them, so we ask that you forgive that when you hear, and if I find out who is singing on this recording, I will of course post it on the blog portion of our website. So
can we just have people call in? And
yeah,
you
all right? Call in. We're a call-in show.
If you hear yourself singing here, please.
You can call. You can call. If you know it's from from 1984, January 1984 performance at the Baltimore Opera Company.
Totally could be David.
So if you listen, if this is David, I will sacrifice a testicle. So this is going to be a fun recording.
If you involve me no longer,
then
I will
see?
You should say it for anyone who might not know.
It took me a bit surprised to hear it in English.
one of the things we discovered in the last podcast was that when we listened to the Onegin recording, it was in English.
Mm-hmm.
And that we were all kind of surprised that even in the 80s, that the Baltimore Opera Company was still doing so much in English. And so, it's in English, which is a little off-putting.
Although, because, I mean, that you commonly hear that in English more than...
These days, not the music. You might hear all the dialogue scenes
between...
But they
still sing the music in German.
But they still sing the music these days in German a lot. And
you still haven't said what it is for our listeners.
Well, yes, it's Ach, ich fühl's from Die Zauberflöte.
So that would be in English.
The Magic Flute. I'm sure that's how they advertised it, right?
Yes.
Since it was in English. But maybe not, because, you know, who knows? But, Washington National Opera, they advertise the operas in English and then sing them in their, you know, original language.
And
so who knows?
By?
Mozart. Well, I mean, come on. If you listen to this podcast, you either A, can look it up on the internet,
fair
or
enough.
B, you already
fair
know.
Enough. Okay. I'm trying to speak out for, like, the, you know, non-opera singers.
No, I think it's definitely good to say what it is.
Yeah. Yes.
But,
we don't know who that was.
Because the thing about the archives are that is, like, all of the things I have pulled so far have, like, what it is and what the date of the performance was.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it has, like, what act of the opera or which... This is tape number one from the opera or whatever.
Sure.
But they don't say, all of them, who is on, who
right.
the cast is.
Cast, yeah.
And so it's one of those things where I don't have that piece. Now... There is somebody else I know who has some pieces to this, but I haven't had the time to coordinate with him. So I'm going to try and coordinate with him to see if I can get access to some of his materials, because he said something about having a lot of the old programs.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I don't know if the programs he has will always match up with what I have in terms of the archival recordings. But hopefully I'll be able to figure out who some of these people are.
Sure, yeah.
I thought, for one thing, let's just say... How about the, like, randomness that there was little to no distortion in this recording?
Oh, I know, right.
Compared to
the last one that was all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, this was actually a listenable recording.
Sure, definitely. Pretty good for a...
31-year-old recording
that
was sitting in the, you know...
In the dump.
In
the basement.
In the basement.
In our basement.
In our
basement.
In
their
basement,
our basement.
Yeah. So, was this recorded at the Lyric?
Yes.
Okay, so it was the same hall. Because one thing that stuck out to me is the recording, like, the way it was mic'd. Because you could tell it was so close to the singer, and the orchestra sounded, like, really far away, and you couldn't even hear any of the nuances of the room. For me, so it's
like,
very
interesting. Because these are when they do archive recordings, it's not for... It's purely for archive purposes.
Sure,
it's not
yeah.
meant for... So, you're right. The last recording was recorded in 1981, and this was in 84. So who knows what they decided to do. Maybe they changed the location of the microphones, either for recording purposes
for recording.
Or maybe even just for, like, logistic purposes, you know?
Yeah, I guess I don't remember that from the last recording, but then again, that was so much more... You know, that was in such more rough shape than this one
right.
was.
Also,
maybe that was also the case for that one, but I just didn't hear it. But yeah, it sounded like she was, like, right up against
it's
it.
It's almost as if the mics
you know,
were right on the edge of the stage, and it was only picking the orchestra that would come, like, back from the house to the microphone.
Which is a shame, because, I mean, it's a great hall, you know. It would have been, if they had maybe just moved it back a little bit, you could have got a little bit of a better mix, you know, of what the real... audience experience would have been.
Sure.
But she, you know.
That aria, to sing that in front of a bunch of people with an orchestra and a conductor staring at you and all that, I mean, it's just so exposed.
Yeah.
I think
part
of them not being able to hear the orchestra is that the texture is so light.
Mm.
It's just such a, I mean, who's also the recording, obviously. But with the Onegin, it's huge. You know, the forces are much bigger.
Yeah, this is it is very delicate orchestration for this.
Very, and you get no help. You're just like standing out there, and you're just singing, and like hoping for the best. You know, nobody's really playing.
Like Bach, it's just right up your alley.
I think this aria is probably a little more terrifying than Bach because of the. Because of the lighter orchestration, because of the nakedness of it. Whereas in Bach, I mean, at least if you have your head about you, it's going to keep moving. And if you just keep moving, you make the mistake and you just keep moving on. This,
that's a good point.
This, you make a mistake
yeah.
and it is like...
On the archival recording and somebody putting it on a podcast and then
it's,
career's over.
Well, yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's 31 years later, so maybe the career is
no,
over
but she
for
did a
very
beautiful
good reasons.
Job. I mean, she did
yeah.
such a lovely job.
Yeah, she did do it.
Great.
I mean, I've been kind of impressed with the quality of the singer so far I've heard that it came through there.
Of course. Yes.
You know, I mean, a lot better than I did when I sang this aria at Peabody in my audition. So.
Oh, boy.
I did. I mean, like, when they were doing Magic Flute,
you did
I was auditioning behind... five sopranos who all sing octave fuse for their aria because we're doing Magic Flute, right? So I walk up to Joanne Calais and I'm like, just start playing octave fuse. So I go up and I start singing octave fuse in falsetto. And I get like through the opening phrase and then like I can't do anymore. But it was the best comic relief ever. Because I'm sure they out there were like, oh God, are we going to hear another one of these? But then I sang Der Vogelfanger, and you know the rest is history. So.
Well, Der Vogelfanger.
Yeah. As long as I mean, you just got the just don't mess up the words in those verses. And strophic singing is the worst. You know, you mix up the words and the verses,
mm-hmm.
and next thing you know, the bird is picking its you know worm out of the. Pool instead of the earth or something. So
that
anyway.
Would really be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Bad news.
I mean, like I remember, I had a mistake like that. I sang from Die Schöne Müller and Das Wander, you know, and I sang that in a recital in undergrad, and I totally mixed up the verses. Totally. There's five verses, and it was like, I'd start in verse one and start singing verse three, and then the next time I'd start in verse two and skip to verse one, and like afterwards there was a German speaker in the audience, and he's like, that was an amazing piece you sang. He's like, I understood every word you sang, but I have no idea what that poem is about. Who wrote it? I'm like, oh, great. So, you know. I just sort of fixed up, man.
How did you memorize something so nonsensical?
I know.
Yeah. But, you know, there are advantages to being a choral singer.
Yeah. If the other 100 people are doing something else,
you know you're wrong.
You know you're wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the nice part is, I mean, not for the next one, but a future podcast, I might pull some more from this because almost the entirety of the opera is in that good shape.
Oh, that's good.
Which
that's
is
good.
Actually kind of nice.
I love By Menon.
Yeah.
But you would never tell me what you were going to play because.
Yes.
No, I mean,
it's top secret.
Yeah, that's
top
right.
Secret.
Well,
top
I mean,
secret
you kind
stuff.
Of have some surprise.
Even
right?
I didn't know.
Even
I lived
didn't
here,
know.
He didn't know.
I know.
Oh,
well,
my goodness. Well,
so the three wines, we should maybe do some reveal.
Yeah, let's find out what they are.
All right. Sounds good. So before we do, who liked number one best? There's zero hands up. Who liked number two best? Holy moly. Who liked number three best? Everybody, wow.
I really liked one, though. It was
yeah,
number,
one was nice,
I
too.
Actually liked it. It was, like, a very different thing.
All right. So, well, that I mean, that's consensus. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So,
yeah, that is pretty cool.
So, let's make sure this is number one. Yep, number one is... Edmund St. John, Rocks and Gravel. It is, this is not from France, but it is a, you know, GSM Côte du Rhône blend from Sonoma County in Dry Creek Valley.
And what does GSM stand for?
It's, we said it at the beginning of the podcast, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre. And it's 50, 25, 25 of those in that order of the three. I really like this one, but it was clearly the lightest body of the three, but that wasn't necessarily a bad thing at all.
No.
It was really lovely. And I think that retails for about 19 a bottle.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know. And this is number two. This is Le Dauphin Côte du Rhône Reserve. It is, you know, it is French. And just confirming it is GSM as well. This is like $9 a bottle.
I think that's a better deal.
I thought this was very, I mean, like, when I first tasted it, I remember I said it opened up. I think really this needs a little time in the glass to be properly balanced. I think when you first pour it out, it's a little too heavy on the dirt. But it's quite lovely, very easy drinking. I think it's very classic what people would think of as Côte du Rhône.
Yeah.
And for $9 a bottle, I mean...
Not bad.
Let's do it.
That's not bad at all, right? Break that, right? Okay, and then the favorite, number three, is the 2010 Domaine Grand Vigneur Le Champauvin Côte du Rhône. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, also GSM. And this is a Côte du Rhône that's about 14 to 15 a bottle. So,
okay.
You know,
so
I mean, if you look at the one that was $9 and you look at this one that's, you know, a little less than twice as much, you know, because that'd be like 18 and this is, you know, about 15, 16. I think this is a good upgrade. I mean, you all liked it the best. I think it's a decent upgrade for that. And I'm going to enjoy drinking the rest of these later on once we finish the podcast. So,
Shelly, stop misbehaving.
There we go. We had to have Shelly in the podcast one last time. Is there anything anybody wants to add before we say adieu? No? All right, so we're just going to munch on chocolate and drink wine, and we look forward to seeing or hearing back from all of you next month.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Playoff song.
Oh, crap. Thank you. Paige, you're wonderful. If Catherine was here, she would have been able to introduce her playoff song. You're right. And the playoff song that she picked, she wanted me to say that she grew up listening to Welsh singers across various genres, folk, classical, jazz, rock, etc. And she picked Shirley Bassey because she feels she has a great voice and loves that she is a Welsh woman from Tiger Bay, Cardiff, left school at age 14 and worked her way up from singing in pubs and clubs to singing for all of the world. And the fact that she's such a show woman, even in her late years, and the recording we're going to hear is when she was 78, ? And still has such a rocking instrument. So this is our playoff song as we will drink wine and eat chocolate.
lovely.